pause at this point. The Commonwealth was confident of the evidence against Marjorie O'Hare. In her initial interview, the old woman had placed Miss O'Hare at the scene, no matter what she claimed afterward. The library book, spattered with blood, appeared to be the only possible murder weapon, given there were no gunshot or stabbing injuries. No other of the Packhorse librarians rode as far as Miss O'Hare, judging by the other ledgers, so the chances of anyone else using a library book as a weapon at that spot were limited. And then there was the difficult matter of Marjorie's character. The many people who would happily speak up about the long-standing feud between her family and the McCulloughs, and Marjorie's habit of saying the least palatable things without considering the impact her words might have on those around her.
"She will need to be mindful of these things when we come to trial," he said, gathering his papers. "It's important that the jury find her a sympathetic defendant."
Sven shook his head mutely.
"You won't get Marge to be anyone other than who she is," said Fred.
"I'm not saying she has to be someone else, but if she cannot win the sympathy of the judge and the jury, her chances of freedom are severely diminished."
The lawyer sat back in his chair and put both hands on the table.
"This is not just about truth, Mr. Gustafson. It's about strategy. And no matter what the truth of this matter is, you can bet that the other side is working hardest on theirs."
"You like it, then?"
"Like what?"
Marjorie looked up.
"Being a mother."
"Got myself so swimming in feelings I don't know which way is up half the time,"
Marjorie said softly, adjusting the cotton vest at Virginia's neck.
"Boy, it's even warm up here. Wish we could catch a breeze."
Since Virginia's birth, Deputy Dulles had allowed the visits to take place in the empty holding cell upstairs. It was lighter and cleaner than those in the basement, and, they suspected, more acceptable to the redoubtable Mrs. Brady. But on a day like today, when the air hung warm and heavy with moisture, there was little relief. Alice thought suddenly how awful the jailhouse would be in winter, with its exposed windows and cold cement floor. How much worse would the state penitentiary be? "She will be free by then," she told herself firmly. "No thinking ahead, no thinking beyond today, this next hour."
"Didn't think I could love another creature like this," Marjorie continued. "Feels like she's taken a layer of skin off me, you know?
Sven is truly besotted.
Ain't he, Jest?"
Marjorie smiled to herself at some memory.
"He's going to be the greatest daddy to you, tiny girl."
Her face shadowed, as if there were something she didn't want to acknowledge. And then it was gone, and she was holding the baby up, gesturing to her head, smiling again.
"You think her hair is going to be dark like mine? She's got a little Cherokee in her, after all. Or you think she'll lighten up more like her daddy? You know, when Sven was a baby, his hair was white as chalk."
Marjorie wouldn't discuss the trial. She would shake her head twice, tiny movements, as if suggesting there was no point in it. And despite this new softness, there was something steely enough in that movement for Alice not to try to contradict it. She had done the same to Beth and to Mrs. Brady when they visited, and Mrs. Brady had arrived back at the library quite pink with frustration.
"I was talking to my husband about the trial and what happens afterward, if things do not go the way we hope. He has some friends in the legal world, and apparently, across state lines, there are some places that allow the children to stay with the mother, and matrons to attend properly to the women. Some have quite good facilities, all told."
Marjorie had acted like she hadn't heard a word.
"We're all praying for you in church, you and Virginia. Isn't she the dearest thing? I just wondered whether you would like us to try to—"
"Appreciate your thoughts, Mrs. Brady, but we'll be fine."
"And that was it," Mrs. Brady said, throwing her hands into the air.
"It's as if she's burying her head in the sand. Honestly, I don't think she can simply rely on the idea of getting out. She needs to plan."
But Alice didn't feel that optimism was at the heart of Marjorie's behavior.
It was one of the many reasons she felt increasingly anxious with every day that the trial grew closer. Exactly 1 week before the trial was due to start, newspapers began to speculate on its suspect. One had got hold of the picture of the women from the Nice and Quick and cropped it so that only Marjorie's face was visible. The headline read, "The Librarian Killer. Did she murder innocent man?" The nearest hotel in Danvers Creek swiftly found itself with every room booked, and there was talk that some neighbors had tidied up back rooms and put beds in them to house the reporters who were also coming to town. It seemed that Marjorie and McCullough were all anybody talked about, except within the confines of the library, where nobody talked about them at all. Sven headed to the jail in the height of the afternoon. It was an excessively warm day, and he walked slowly, using his hat to fan himself, and raising a hand in greeting to those he passed, his outward demeanor revealing nothing of what he felt inside. He handed the tin of Alice's cornbread to Deputy Dulles and checked his pockets for the clean vest and bib that Alice had folded neatly for him to bring. Marjorie was in the holding cell upstairs, feeding the baby, seated cross-legged on the bunk, and he waited to kiss her, knowing as he did how easily distracted the baby was. Usually she would raise a cheek for him, but this time she kept gazing down at the child, so after a moment, he sat down on the stool nearby.
"She's still feeding all night?"
"Much as she can get."
"Mrs. Brady said she might be one of those babies needs solid food early. I got a book about it from the girls, just to read up a little."
"Since when have you been chatting with Mrs. Brady about babies?"
He looked at his boots.
"Since I quit my job."
When she stared at him, he added,
"Don't worry. I've not been out of work since I was 14 years old, and Fred is letting me stay in his spare room, so I'm good. We'll be good."
Marjorie didn't speak. Some days she was like this now, would barely say a word the whole time he was there. Those days had grown fewer since Virginia arrived. It was as if she couldn't help but talk to the child, even if she was feeling down, but Sven still hated to see them. He rubbed at his head.
"Alice said to tell you the chickens are doing fine. Winnie laid a double yoker. Charlie's getting fat. Quite enjoying the rest, far as I can see it. We've got him turned out this week with Fred's young ones, and he's showing them who's boss."
She looked down at Virginia, checking that she had finished, then adjusted her dress and placed the baby against her shoulder for burping.
"You know, I was thinking," Sven continued, "maybe when you come home, we could get another dog. There's a farmer over at Shelbyville got a hunting bitch I've fancied for a long time that he wants to put to pup. She's got a sweet nature. It's good for a child to grow up around a dog. If we get a puppy, he and Virginia could grow up together. What do you say?"
"Sven?"
"I mean, we don't have to get a dog. Could wait till she's a little older. I just thought..."
"You remember I once told you I would never tell you to leave me?"
Still, she kept her eyes on the child.
"I do indeed. Almost made you write it on a piece of paper for proof."
He raised a wry smile.
"Well, I made a mistake. I need you to go."
He leaned forward, his head cocked.
"I'm sorry, what?"
"And I need you to take Virginia."
When she finally looked up at him, her eyes were wide and serious.
"I was arrogant, Sven. I thought I could live as I wanted, long as I didn't hurt nobody. But I've had time to think in here, and I worked it out. You don't get to do that in Lee County. Maybe not in the whole of Kentucky, not if you're a woman. You play by their rules, or they, well, they squash you like a bug."
Her voice was calm and even, as if she had rehearsed the words in her many silent hours.
"I need you to take her far away. To New York State, or Chicago, maybe even the West Coast if there's work. Take her somewhere beautiful. Somewhere she can have opportunities and a good education and not have to worry about whatever shitty scars her family left on her future before she was even born. Take her from people who will judge her for her name long before she can even spell it."
He was nonplussed.
You're talking crazy, Marge. I'm not leaving you.
For 20 years? You know that's what they're going to give me even if I get manslaughter, and it'll be worse if it's murder.
But you didn't do nothing wrong.
You think they care a whit about that? You know how this town works. You know they're gunning for me.
He looked at her as if she were mad.
I'm not going, so you can forget it.
Well, I'm not going to see you anymore, so you don't get a say.
What? What are you talking about now?
This is the last time I'm going to see you. It's one of the few rights I get in here, the right not to see visitors. Sven, I know you're a good man, and you'll do anything to help me, and by God, I love you for it, but this is about Virginia now. So I need you to promise me you'll do as I ask and never bring our daughter back to this place.
She leaned back against the wall.
But what about the trial?
I don't want you there.
Sven stood up.
This is crazy talk. I'm not listening to this.
Marjorie's voice lifted. She lurched forward and gripped his hand, stopping him.
Sven, I have nothing left. I have no freedom, no dignity, no future. The only damn thing I have is hope that for this girl, my heart, the thing I love most in the whole world, it might work out different. So if you love me like you say you do, give me what I'm asking. I don't want my baby's childhood marked out in visits to the jail. I will not have you both watch me waste away week by week, year by year in the state prison with lice in my hair and the stink of the slop buckets, beat down by the bigots that run this town and going slowly stir crazy. I will not have her seeing it. You'll make her happy, I know you can, and when you talk of me, you tell her not of this, but of me riding out on Charlie in the mountains, doing what I love to do.
His hand closed around hers. His voice broke, and he kept shaking his head in a way that suggested he wasn't even sure he was doing it.
I can't leave you, Marge.
She withdrew her hand. She took the sleeping baby and placed her gently in his arms. Then Marjorie leaned forward and placed a kiss on the baby's head. She kept her lips there for a moment, her eyes closed tight. She opened them, drinking her in as if she were imprinting some part of her deep within.
Bye-bye, sweetheart. Mama loves you very much.
She touched the back of his knuckles lightly with her fingertips, an instruction. And then, as Sven sat in shock, Marjorie O'Hare stood upright, her hand braced on the table, and shouted for the jailer to walk her to her cell. She didn't look back. True to her word, he was the last visitor she saw. Alice arrived that afternoon with a pound cake, and Deputy Dulles said regretfully, for he did love Alice's cakes, that he was real sorry, but Miss O'Hare was adamant she didn't want to see anyone that day.
Is there a problem with the baby?
Baby ain't there no more. She left with her daddy this morning. He was real sorry, but rules was rules, and he couldn't force Miss O'Hare to see Alice. He did, however, agree to take the cake with the promise he'd carry it down to her later. When Kathleen Bly went 2 days later, she would receive the same response, and Sophia and Mrs. Brady after her. Alice rode home, her mind spinning, and found Sven on the porch with the baby resting on his shoulder, her button eyes wide at the unfamiliar sunlight and the moving shadows of the trees.
Sven?
Alice dismounted, hooked Spirit's reins over the post.
Sven, what on earth is going on?
He couldn't look at her. His eyes were red-rimmed, and he kept his face turned away.
Sven?
She's the stubbornest damn woman in Kentucky.
On cue, the baby started to cry, the raw, ragged cries of a child who has had to cope with too many changes in a single day and is suddenly, catastrophically overwhelmed. Sven patted her back ineffectually, and after a moment, Alice stepped forward and took the baby from him. His face sank into his broad, scarred hands. The baby nuzzled into Alice's shoulder, then pulled her head back, her tiny mouth an O of dismay, as if appalled by the discovery that this was not her mother.
We'll fix it, Sven. will make her see sense.
He shook his head.
Why would we?
His voice emerged muffled through his rough hands.
She's right. That's the worst of it, Alice. She's right.
Through Kathleen, who knew everything and everyone, Alice found a woman in the next town who would wet nurse the baby, her own having recently weaned, for a small sum. Every morning, Sven would drive the baby over to the white clabbered farmhouse, and little Virginia would be handed over for food and care. It made all of them a little uneasy to see it. The child belonged with her mother, and Virginia herself had swiftly become withdrawn, her eyes watchful, her thumb plugged warily into her mouth as if she no longer trusted the world to be a benign and reliable place. But what else could they do? The child was fed. Sven was free to find work. Alice and the girls were able to get by as best they could, and if their hearts were sick and their stomachs tight with nerves, well, that was the way it was. Chapter 23. I don't ask you to love me always like this, but I ask you to remember. Somewhere inside me, there will always be the person I am tonight. F. Scott Fitzgerald, Tender is the Night. A near circus atmosphere descended on Baileyville, the kind of commotion that made Tex Lafayette's appearance look like a Sunday school reunion. As news of the start date had broken across the town, the mood seemed to shift, and not necessarily in Marjorie's favor. The extended McCullough clan began to arrive from out of town, distant cousins from Tennessee, from Michigan and North Carolina, some of whom had barely seen McCullough in decades, but who now found themselves highly invested in the idea of retribution for their beloved relative, and swiftly took to congregating outside either the jailhouse or the library to shout abuse and threaten vengeance. Fred had come down twice from his house to try to calm things, and when that failed, to reveal his gun and announce that the women must be allowed to get on with their work. The town seemed split in two with their arrival, dividing between those who were disposed to see all the wrong in Marjorie's family as evidence of her own bad blood, and those who preferred to go on their own experience and thanked her for bringing books and a little pleasantry into their lives. Twice, Beth got into fist fights on the back of Marjorie's reputation, once in the store and once on the steps outside the library, and had taken to walking around with her hands bunched, as if permanently braced to throw a punch. Izzy wept frequently and silently, and would shake her head mutely if anyone spoke to her of it, as if the act of talking were too much. Kathleen and Sophia said little, but their somber faces told of which way they thought this would go. Alice could no longer visit the jail, in accordance with Marjorie's wishes, but felt her presence in the little concrete building as if they were connected by threads. She was eating a little, Deputy Dulles said when she stopped by. Didn't speak much, though. Seemed to spend a lot of time sleeping. Sven left town. He bought a small wagon and a young horse, packed up what remained of his belongings, and moved out of Fred's to a one-room cabin a short distance from the wet nurse on the eastern side of the Cumberland Gap. He could not stay in Baileyville, not with people saying what they were, not with the prospect of seeing the woman he loved brought even lower, and the crying baby in earshot of her mother. His eyes were red with exhaustion, and new deep grooves ran down each side of his mouth that had nothing to do with the baby. Fred promised him at the first word of anything, he would drive right over.
I'll tell her,
Fred began, then realized he had no idea what he would tell Marjorie. They exchanged a look, then slapped each other on the shoulder, in the way near silent men have of conveying emotion, and Sven drove off with his hat pulled low over his brow and his mouth set in a grim line. Alice also began to pack up. In the quiet of the little cabin, she began to separate her clothes into those she might find some use for in England, in her future life, and those she could not imagine wearing again. She would hold up the fine silk blouses, the elegantly cut skirts, gossamer slips, and nightwear, and frown. Had she ever been this person? In the emerald floral tea dresses and lace collars? Had she really required all these hair rollers, setting lotions, and pearl brooches? She felt as if such ephemera belonged to someone she no longer knew. She waited until she had completed this task before she told the girls. By this stage, they had all, by some unspoken agreement, taken to staying at the library together until way beyond their finishing time. It was as if this was the only place they could bear to be. 2 nights before the trial was due to start, she waited until Kathleen began gathering her bags, then said, "So, I have some news. I'm leaving. If anyone wants any of my things, I'll be leaving a trunk of clothes in the library for you all to go through. You're welcome to any of it."
"Leaving where?"
"Here," she swallowed. "I have to go back to England." There was a heavy silence. Izzy's hands flew to her mouth.
"You can't leave?"
"Well, I can't stay, unless I go back to Bennett. Van Cleave will come after me once he's got Marjorie safely locked up."
"Don't say that," said Beth.
There was a lengthy silence. Alice tried to ignore the looks passing between the other women.
"Is Bennett so bad?"
said Izzy.
"I mean, if you could persuade him to move out of his daddy's shadow, maybe you two would have a chance. Then you could stay."
How could she explain how impossible it would be to return to Bennett, feeling as she did about Fred? She would rather be a million miles from Fred than have to walk past him every day and know she had to go back to another man. Fred had barely touched her, yet she felt they understood each other better than she and Bennett ever had.
"I can't. And you know Van Cleave won't rest until he's got rid of the Packhorse Library, too, which will put us all out of a job. Fred saw him with the sheriff, and Kathleen saw him twice last week with the governor. He's working a way to undermine us.
But if we don't have Marjorie, and we don't have you..."
Izzy's voice trailed away.
"Does Fred know?" said Sophia.
Alice nodded. Sophia's eyes held hers, as if confirming something.
"When are you going?" said Izzy.
"Soon as the trial is done."
Fred had barely spoken the whole drive home. She had wanted to reach out, to touch his hand and tell him she was sorry, that this was so far from what she wanted, but she was so frozen with grief at her possession of the paper ticket that she couldn't move. Izzy rubbed at her eyes and sniffed.
"Feels like everything's fallen apart. Everything we worked for, our friendship, this place, everything has just fallen apart."
Normally, when one of the women expressed such dramatic sentiments, the others would leap on her, telling her to stop being ridiculous, that she was crazy, that she simply needed a good night's sleep, or some food, or to get a hold of herself. It was her monthlies talking. It was a measure of how low they all felt, that this time, nobody said a word. Sophia broke the silence. She took an audible breath and placed both hands palm down on the table.
"Well, for now, we keep going. Beth, I don't believe you've entered your books from this afternoon. If you'd be kind enough to bring them over here, I'll do them for you. And Alice, if you can give me the exact day you're planning on leaving, I'll adjust the payroll."
Overnight, 2 trailer homes arrived on the road by the courthouse. Extra state policemen were visible around town, and a crowd began to build outside the jailhouse by tea time on Monday, fueled by a newspaper report in the Lexington Courier headlined, "Moonshiner's Daughter Killed Man with Library Book in Blood Feud."
"This is trash,"
Kathleen said when Mrs. Bydecker handed her a copy at the school. But that didn't stop the people gathering, a few starting to catcall out back so that the sound would reach through the open window of Marjorie's cell. Deputy Dulles came out twice, his palms up, trying to calm them, but a tall, mustachioed man in an ill-fitting suit, whom nobody had seen before and claimed to be Clem McCullough's cousin, said they were just exercising their God-given right to free speech. And if he wanted to talk about what a murdering bitch that O'Hare girl was, then it was nobody else's damn business. They jostled each other, fueling their bold claims with alcohol, and by dusk, the yard outside the jailhouse was thick with people, some drunk, some shouting insults at Marjorie, others yelling back at them that they were not from round here, and why didn't they keep their troublemaking ways to themselves? The older ladies of the town withdrew behind their doors, muttering, and some of the younger men, emboldened by the chaos, started a bonfire by the garage. It felt, briefly, as if the orderly little town had become a place where almost anything could happen, and none of it good. Word got to the librarians as they returned from their routes, and each put away her horse and sat in silence with the door open for a while, listening to the distant sounds of protest.
"Murdering bitch! You gonna get yours, you whore! Now, now, gentlemen, there are ladies in this crowd. Let's keep things reasonable."
"I swear I'm glad Sven isn't here to see it," said Beth.
"You know he wouldn't stand to hear Marge talked about that way."
"I can't bear it," said Izzy, who was watching through the door. "Imagine how she must be feeling having to listen to all that.
She'll be so sad without the baby, too."
It was all Alice could think about. To be the recipient of such hate without the prospect of a word of comfort from those who loved you. The way Marjorie had isolated herself made Alice want to weep. It was like an animal that deliberately takes itself off somewhere solitary before it dies.
"Lord help our girl," Sophia said quietly.
And then Mrs. Brady walked through the door, glancing behind her, her cheeks ruddy and her hair electric with fury.
"I swear, I thought this town knew better. I am ashamed of my neighbors, I really am. I can only imagine what Mrs. Nofsier would say if she happened to catch wind of this."
"Fred reckons they'll be out there all night."
"I simply do not know what this town is coming to. Why Sheriff Archer doesn't take a bullwhip to them, I have no idea. I swear, we're becoming worse than Harlan."
It was then that they heard Van Cleve's voice rising above the swell of the crowd.
"You can't say I didn't warn you, people. She's a danger to men and to this town. The court is going to hear what kind of malign influence the O'Hare girl is, you mark my words. Only one place for her."
"Oh, hell, now he's fixing to stir things up," said Beth.
"Folks, you will hear how much of an abomination the girl is, against the laws of nature. Nothing she says can be trusted."
"That does it," said Izzy, her jaw clenched.
Mrs. Brady turned to look at her daughter as Izzy climbed to her feet. She grabbed her stick and walked to the door.
"Mother, will you come with me?"
They moved as one, pulling on boots and hats in silence. And then, without discussion, they stood together at the top of the steps, Kathleen and Beth, Izzy and Mrs. Brady, and after a moment's hesitation, Sophia, who rose from behind her desk, her face tense but determined, reaching for her purse. The others stopped to look at her. Then Alice, her heart in her throat, held out her arm, and Sophia slid her own through it. And the six women walked out of the library and, in a tight group, along the shimmering road toward the jailhouse in silence, their faces set and their pace determined. The crowd broke as they arrived, partly through the sheer force of Mrs. Brady, whose elbows were out and whose expression was thunderous, but partly in shock at the colored woman who stood between them, her arms linked with those of Bennett Van Cleve's wife and the Bly widow. Mrs. Brady reached the front of the crowd and pushed her way through so that she was standing with her back to the jail and turned to face them.
"Are you not ashamed of yourselves?" she bellowed at them. "What kind of men are you?"
"She's a murderer."
"In this country, we believe in the presumption of innocence unless proven otherwise. So you can take your disgusting words and your slogans, and you can darn well leave that girl alone until the law says you have good reason.
She pointed at the mustachioed man.
What business do you have in our town anyway? I swear some of you are here just to cause trouble, because you're sure as anything not from Baileyville. I'm Clem's second cousin. Got a right to be here as much as anyone. I cared about my cousin. Caring cousin my backside, said Mrs. Brady. Where were you when his daughters were starving, their hair full of cooties? When they were stealing food from people's gardens because he was too drunk to bother feeding them? Where were you then, huh? You have no genuine feeling for that family.
You're just sticking up for your own. We all know what them librarians have been up to.
You know nothing, retorted Mrs. Brady. And you, Henry Porteous, why, I thought you were old enough to know better. As for this fool, she pointed at Van Cleve, I honestly believed our neighbors would have more sense than to trust a man who has built an entire fortune on the back of misery and destruction, mostly at this town's cost. How many of you lost your homes to his slurry dam, huh? How many of you were given warning to save yourselves by Miss O'Hare there? And yet, given baseless rumor and gossip, you would rather castigate a woman than look at the true criminal around here.
Those are slanderous words, Patricia. So sue me, Jeffrey.
Van Cleve's skin flushed florid purple.
I've warned y'all. She's a malign influence.
You're the only malign influence around here. Why do you think your daughter-in-law would rather live in a cowshed than share one more night in your house? What kind of man beats up on his son's wife? And you stand there presenting yourself as some kind of moral arbiter. Why, the way we judge the behavior of men against women in this town is genuinely shocking.
The crowd began to murmur.
What kind of woman kills a decent man with no provocation?
This has nothing to do with McCullough, and you know it. This is about getting back at a woman who showed you up for what you are.
See, ladies and gentlemen, this is the true face of that so-called library. A coarsening of female discourse, behavior contrary to what's proper. Why, do you think it's right that Mrs. Brady should speak in such a way?
The crowd surged forward and was stopped abruptly by two gunshots in the air. There was a scream. People ducked, glancing around nervously. Sheriff Archer appeared in the back doorway to the jailhouse. He surveyed the crowd.
Now, I've been a patient man, but I do not want to hear one more word out here. The court will decide this case from tomorrow, and due process will be followed. And if one more of you steps out of line, you'll be finding yourself in the jailhouse alongside Miss O'Hare. That goes for you too, Jeffrey, and you, Patricia. I'll put any one of yous away. You hear me?
We got a right to free speech, a man shouted.
You do, and I got a right to make sure you're speaking it from one of my cells down there.
The crowd began to yell again, the words ugly, the voices harsh and clamorous. Alice looked around her and began to tremble, chilled by the venom, the hate etched on faces she had previously waved a cheery good morning to. How could they turn on Marjorie like this? She felt something fearful and panicky rise in her chest, the energy of the crowd charging the air around her. And then she felt Kathleen nudge her and saw that Izzy had stepped forward. As the protesters railed and chanted around her, pushing and jostling, she limped her way out in front of them, a little unsteady and resting on her stick until she was underneath the cell window. And as everyone watched, Izzy Brady, who struggled to stand in front of an audience of five, turned to face the shifting crowd, looked around her, and took a deep breath. And she began to sing. Abide with me, fast falls the eventide, the darkness deepens, Lord, with me abide. She paused, took a breath, her eyes flickering around her. When other helpers fail and comforts flee,
Help of the helpless, oh, abide with me. The crowd quieted, unsure at first what was going on, those at the back straining on tiptoe to see. A man catcalled, and someone cursed him. Izzy stood, her hands clasped in front of her, shaking slightly, and sang out, her voice growing in strength and intensity. Swift to its close ebbs out life's little day. Earth's joys grow dim, its glories pass away. Change and decay in all around I see. O thou who changest not, abide with me. Mrs. Brady, her back straightening, took 2, 3 strides, pushed through the crowd, and placed herself beside her daughter, her back against the outside of the jailhouse wall and her chin lifted. As they sang together, Kathleen, then Beth, and finally Sophia and Alice, their arms still linked, moved to stand beside them and lifted their voices too, their heads up and their gaze steady, facing down the crowd. As the men shouted insults, their 6 voices grew in volume, drowning them out, determined and unafraid. Come not in terrors as the King of Kings, but kind and good, with healing in thy wings. Tears for all woes, a heart for every plea. Come, friend of sinners, and thus abide with me. They sang until the crowd was silent, watched by Sheriff Archer. They sang, pressed shoulder to shoulder, hands reaching blindly for hands, their hearts beating fast but their voices steady. A handful of townspeople stepped forward and joined them. Mrs. Bydecker, the gentleman from the feed shop, Jim Horner and his girls, their hands clasped together and their voices lifting, drowning the sounds of hate, feeling the resonance of each word, sending comfort, while trying to offer a little of that elusive substance to themselves. A few inches away, on the other side of the wall, Marjorie O'Hare lay motionless on the bunk, her hair stuck to her face in damp tendrils, her skin pale and hot. She had lain there for almost 4 days now, her breasts aching, her arms empty in a way that made her feel as if someone had reached inside her and simply ripped out whatever kept her upright. What was there to stand up for now, to hope for even? She was unnaturally still, her eyes closed, the rough hessian against her skin, listening only dimly to the crowd hurling abuse outside. Someone had managed to throw a stone through the window earlier, and it had caught her leg, where a long scratch remained, livid with blood. Hold thou thy cross before my closing eyes, shine through the gloom and point me to the skies. She opened her eyes at a sound that was both familiar and strange, blinking as she focused, and it gradually registered that the sound was Izzy, her unforgettable, sweet voice rising into the air outside the high window, so close she could almost touch it. It told of a world far beyond this cell, of goodness and kindness, of a wide, unending sky into which a voice could soar. She pushed herself up onto her elbow, listening. And then another voice joined hers, deeper and more resonant. And then, as she straightened, there they were, separate voices she could just distinguish from the others. Kathleen, Sophia, Beth, Alice. Heaven's morning breaks, and earth's vain shadows flee. In life, in death, O Lord, abide with me. She heard them and realized then that it was to her they were singing, heard Alice's shout as the hymn drew to a close, her voice still clear as crystal.
You stay strong, Marjorie. We're with you. We're right here with you.
Marjorie O'Hare lowered her head to her knees, her hands covering her face, and at last she sobbed. Chapter 24. I loved something I made up, something that's just as dead as Melly is. I made a pretty suit of clothes and fell in love with it.
And when Ashley came riding along, so handsome, so different, I put that suit on him and made him wear it whether it fitted him or not. And I wouldn't see what he really was. I kept on loving the pretty clothes, and not him at all. Margaret Mitchell, Gone with the Wind. By common agreement, on the opening day of the trial, the WPA Packhorse Library of Baileyville, Kentucky, remained closed, as did the post office, the Pentecostal, Episcopalian, First Presbyterian, and Baptist churches, and the general store, which opened only for an hour at 7 a.m. and then again for the lunch hour to cater to the influx of strangers who had arrived in Baileyville. Unfamiliar cars parked at haphazard angles all along the roadside from the courthouse. Mobile homes dotted the nearby fields, and men with sharp suits and trilby hats walked the streets with notebooks in the dawn light, asking for background information, photographs, anything you like, on the murdering librarian Marjorie O'Hare. When they reached the library, Mrs. Brady waved a broom at them, told them she would take the head off any one of them who ventured into her building without an invitation, and they could put that in their darned paper and print it. She didn't seem to care too much what Mrs. Knofsier might think of that. State policemen stood talking in pairs on the corners of the streets, and refreshment stands had been set up around the courthouse, while a snake charmer invited the crowds to test their nerve and come closer, and the honky-tonks offered special deals on 2-for-1 keg beers at the end of every court day. Mrs. Brady decided there was little point in the girls trying to make their rounds today. The roads were clogged, their minds were all over the place, and each of them wanted to be in court for Marjorie. And anyway, long before 7 that morning, there was a queue of people trying to get into the public gallery. Alice stood at the head of it. As she waited, joined by Kathleen and the others, the queue built swiftly behind them. Neighbors with lunch pails, somber recipients of library books, people she didn't recognize, who seemed to think of this as fun, chatting merrily, joking and nudging each other. She wanted to scream at them, "This is not some nice day out. Marjorie's innocent. She shouldn't even be here." Van Cleve arrived, pulling his car into the sheriff's parking slot, as if to let them all know just how close to the proceedings he was. He didn't acknowledge her, but marched straight into court, jaw jutting, confident his own place had already been reserved. She didn't see Bennett. Perhaps he was minding business at Hoffman. He had never been much of a gossip, unlike his father. Alice waited silently, her mouth dry and her stomach tight, as if it were she, not Marjorie, who was on trial. She guessed the others felt the same. They barely exchanged a word, just a nod of greeting and a brief, tight clasp of hands. At 8:30, the doors opened and the crowd flooded in. Sophia took a seat at the back with the other colored folk. Alice nodded at her. It felt wrong that she wasn't sitting with them. Another example of a world out of kilter. Alice took her seat near the front of the public gallery on the wooden bench, flanked by her remaining friends, and wondered how they were meant to endure this for days. The jury was called. All men, mostly tobacco farmers, judging by their clothes, Alice thought, and none likely to be sympathetic to a sharp-talking, unmarried woman with a bad name. Women, the clerk announced, would be allowed to leave several minutes before the men at lunchtime, and at the end of the day, in order to prepare meals, a fact which caused Beth to roll her eyes. And then Marjorie was led into the dock with cuffs around her wrists, as if she were a danger to those present, her appearance in court accompanied by low murmurs and exclamations from the gallery. She sat pale and silent, apparently uninterested in her surroundings, and barely met Alice's eye. Her hair hung lank and unwashed, and she looked impossibly weary, deep gray shadows under her eyes. Her arms lay in an unconscious loop in a way that might have supported a baby had Virginia still been there. She looked unkempt and uncaring. She looked, Alice thought with dismay, like a criminal. Fred had said he would sit a row behind Alice for appearance's sake, and she turned to him, anguished. His mouth tightened, as if to say he understood, but what could you do? And then Judge Arthur D. Arthurs arrived, chewing ruminatively on a wad of tobacco, and they all were standing on the instructions of the clerk. He sat, and Marjorie was asked to confirm that she was, indeed, Marjorie O'Hare of the old cabin, Thompson's Pass, and the clerk read out the charge against her. How did she plead? Marjorie seemed to sway a little, and her eyes slid toward the public gallery. Not guilty, she answered quietly, and there was a loud scoffing sound from the right-hand side of the court, followed by the loud banging of the judge's gavel. He would not, repeat, not have an unruly court, and nobody here was to so much as sniff without his permission. Did he make himself understood? The crowd settled, albeit with an air of vaguely suppressed mutiny. Marjorie looked up at the judge, and after a moment, he nodded at her to sit down again, and that would be the extent of her animation until she was allowed to leave the courtroom. The morning crept forward in legal increments, women fanning themselves and small children fidgeting in their seats as the prosecuting counsel outlined the case against Marjorie O'Hare. It would be clear to all, he announced in a somewhat nasal, showman's voice, that before them was a woman brought up without morals, without concern for the decent, rightful way of doing things, without faith. Even her most visible enterprise, the so-called Packhorse Library, had proven to be a front for less savory preoccupations, and the state would show evidence of these through evidence from witnesses shaken by examples of her moral laxity. These deficiencies in both character and behavior had found their apotheosis one afternoon up on Arnott's Ridge when the accused had come across the sworn enemy of her late father and taken advantage of the isolated position and inebriation of Mr. Clem McCullough to finish what their feuding descendants had started. While this went on, and it did go on, for the prosecuting counsel loved the sound of his own voice, the reporters from Lexington and Louisville scribbled furiously in small lined notebooks, shielding their work from each other and looking up intently at every new piece of information. When he came to the bit about moral laxity, Beth called out, "Bull crap!" earning herself a cuff from her father, who sat behind her, and a stern rebuke from the judge, who announced that one more word from her and she would be sitting outside in the dust for the rest of the trial. She listened to the remainder of the statement with her arms folded and the kind of expression that made Alice fear for the prosecution lawyer's tires.
You watch. Those reporters will write that these mountains run red with blood feuds and such nonsense, muttered Mrs. Brady from behind her. They always do. Makes us sound like a bunch of savages. You won't read a word about all the good this library or Marjorie has done.
Kathleen sat silently on one side of Alice, Izzy the other. They listened carefully, their faces serious and still, and when he finished, they exchanged looks that said they now understood what Marjorie was up against. Blood feuds aside, the Marjorie the court had described was so duplicitous, so monstrous, that if they had not known her, they might have been afraid to sit just a few feet away from her, too. Marjorie seemed to know it. She looked deadened, as if the very thing that made her Marjorie had been squeezed out of her, leaving only an empty shell. Alice wished for the hundredth time that Sven had not absented himself. Surely, no matter what she'd told him, Marjorie would have taken some comfort from having him there. Alice kept imagining what it must be like to be sitting in the dock, facing the end of everything she loved and held dear. It hit her then that Marjorie, who loved nothing better than solitude, to be left alone, unexamined, and who belonged outside, like a mule or a tree or a buzzard, was going to be in one of those tiny dark cells for 10, 20 years, if not the rest of her life. And then she had to stand and push her way out of the gallery because she knew she was going to throw up from fear.
You okay?
Kathleen arrived behind her as she spat into the dust.
Sorry,
Alice said, straightening.
I don't know what came over me.
Kathleen passed her a handkerchief, and she wiped her mouth.
Izzy's holding our seats, but we'd best not be too long. People are already eyeing them.
I just can't bear it, Kathleen, seeing her like that, seeing the town like this. It's like they just want the slightest excuse to think badly of her. It should be the evidence on trial, but it feels like it's the fact that she doesn't behave like they think she should.
It's ugly, that's for sure.
Alice stopped for a minute.
What did you just say?
Kathleen frowned.
I said it's ugly, seeing the town close against her like this.
Kathleen looked at her.
What? What did I say?
Ugly. Alice kicked at a stone on the ground, digging her toe in until it dislodged. There is always a way out of a situation. Might be ugly, might leave you feeling like the earth has gone and shifted under your feet. When she looked up, her face had cleared.
Nothing. Just something Marge once said to me. Just...
She shook her head.
Nothing.
Kathleen held out her arm, and they walked back in. There were lengthy lawyers' arguments behind the scenes, and these blurred into a break at lunchtime, and when the women left the courtroom, they didn't know quite what to do with themselves, so ended up walking slowly back toward the library in a clump, followed by Fred and Mrs. Brady, deep in conversation.
You don't have to go back in this afternoon, you know,
said Izzy, who was still a little appalled by the idea of Alice throwing up in public.
If it's too much for you.
It was just nerves getting the better of me, said Alice.
I was the same when I was a little girl. Should have made myself eat some breakfast.
They walked on in silence.
It'll probably be better once our side gets to speak, Izzy said.
Yeah, Sven's fancy lawyer will put them straight, said Beth.
Of course he will, said Alice.
But none of them sounded convinced. Day two, it turned out, was not much better. The prosecution team outlined the autopsy report on Clem McCullough. The victim, a 57-year-old man, had died from a traumatic head injury consistent with a blunt instrument to the back of the head. He also had suffered facial bruising.
Such as, for example, could be caused by a heavy, hard-backed book?
That could be the case, yes,
said the physician who had conducted the autopsy.
Or a bar fight,
suggested Mr. Turner, the defense lawyer. The physician thought for a moment.
Well, yes, that too, but he was some way from a bar.
The area around the body had not been carefully examined, given the remoteness of the trail. Two of the sheriff's men had carried it down the mountain track, a journey that had taken several hours, and a late snowfall had covered the ground where it had lain, but there was photographic evidence of blood and possibly hoof prints. Mr. McCullough had not owned a horse or mule. The prosecution counsel then interviewed their witnesses. There was old Nancy, who was pushed again and again to confirm that her first statement had stated clearly that she had heard Marjorie up on the ridge, followed by the sound of an altercation.
But I didn't say it like you've made it sound,
she protested, her hand reaching for her hair. She turned to look at the judge.
They twisted my words all this way and that. I know Marjorie. I know she would no more murder a man in cold blood than she would, I don't know, bake a cake.
This prompted laughter in the courtroom and a furious outburst from the judge, and Nancy put both hands to her face, guessing, probably correctly, that even that simile would add to the idea that Marjorie was somehow transgressive, that in her non-baking habits, she went against the laws of nature. The prosecution counsel got her to talk some more about how isolated the route was, very, how often she saw anyone up there, rarely, and how many people regularly made the trip. Only Marjorie, or the odd hunter.
No further questions, Your Honor.
Well, I would like to add one thing,
Nancy announced as the court clerk made to lead her out of the witness box. She turned to point at the dock.
That there is a good, kindly girl. She's brought us reading books through rain and shine, both for me and my sister, who ain't left her bed since 1933. And you so-called Christian folk judging her might want to think hard about how much you do for your fellow man, because you're none of you so high and mighty that you're beyond judgment. She's a good girl, and this is a terrible wrong you're doing her. Oh, and Mr. Judge, my sister has a message for you, too.
That would be Phyllis Stone, older sister of the witness. She is apparently bedridden and could not make it down the mountain,
murmured the clerk to the judge. Judge Arthurs leaned back. There may have been a faint roll of his eyes.
Go ahead, Mrs. Stone.
She wanted me to tell you, y'all can go to hell, because who's going to bring us our Mac McGuire books now?
She said loudly. Then she nodded.
Yep, y'all can go to hell. That was it.
And as the judge began to bang his gavel again, Beth and Kathleen, on each side of Alice, couldn't help but let out a small burst of laughter. Despite that moment of cheer, the librarians left the building that evening in muted mood, their faces drawn, as if the verdict could only be a formality. Alice and Fred walked together at the rear, their elbows bumping occasionally, both deep in thought.
It might improve once Mr. Turner gets his say,
said Fred as they reached the library building. Perhaps. He stopped as the others went inside.
Would you like something to eat before you head off?
Alice glanced behind her at the people still spilling out of the upper level of the courthouse, and felt suddenly mutinous. Why shouldn't she eat where she wanted? How much of a sin could it be, given everything else that was going on?
That would be lovely, Fred. Thank you.
She walked up to Fred's house alongside him, her back straight, daring anybody to comment, and they moved around each other in the kitchen, preparing a meal in some strange facsimile of domesticity, one that neither of them felt able to remark upon. They didn't talk of Marjorie or Sven or the baby, even though those three souls were lodged almost permanently in their thoughts. They didn't talk of how Alice had divested herself of almost all the belongings she had acquired since arriving in Kentucky, and that just one small trunk now sat in Marjorie's cabin, neatly labeled and awaiting her passage home. They remarked on the good taste of the food, the surprising harvest of apples that year, the erratic behavior of one of his new horses, and a book Fred had read called Of Mice and Men, which he wished he hadn't, despite the quality of the writing, as it was too darn depressing just now. And 2 hours later, Alice set off for the cabin, and while she smiled at Fred as she left, because it was almost impossible for her not to smile at Fred, within minutes of her departure, she found that, behind her benign exterior, she was filled with a now semi-permanent rage at a world where she could sit alongside the man she loved for only a matter of days more, and at a small town where three lives were about to be ruined forever because of a crime a woman had not committed. The week slid forward in fury-inducing fits and starts. Every day the librarians took their seats at the front of the public gallery, and every day they listened to various expert witnesses expounding and dissecting the facts of the case. That the blood on the edition of Little Women matched that of Clem McCullough, that the bruising to the front of his face and forehead was consistent with a blow from the same. As the week drew on, the court heard from the so-called character witnesses, the purse-mouthed wife who announced that Marjorie O'Hare had pressed upon her a book she and her husband could only describe as obscene. The fact that Marjorie had just had a baby out of wedlock, and with no visible shame whatsoever. There were the various older men, Henry Porteous for one, who felt able to testify to the length of the O'Hare's feud with the McCulloughs, and the capacity for meanness and vengeance in both families. The defense counsel tried to pick apart these testimonies in the interests of balance. Sheriff, isn't it true that Miss O'Hare has never been arrested once in her 38 years for any crime whatsoever?
It is, the sheriff conceded.
Mind you, plenty of moonshiners around here ain't never seen the inside of a cell either.
Objection. I'm just saying, Your Honor, just because a person ain't been arrested don't mean they behave like an angel. You know how things work around these parts.
The judge ordered the statement expunged from the record, but it had done what the sheriff had known it would, and stained Marjorie's name in some vague, unformed way, and Alice watched the jurors frowning and making little notes on their pads, and saw Van Cleve's slow, satisfied smile along the bench. Fred had noted that the sheriff now smoked the same brand of fancy cigar as Van Cleve, imported all the way from France. How was that for a coincidence? By Friday evening, the librarians were despondent. Lurid headline had followed lurid headline. The crowds, while having thinned a little, at least to the point where baskets of food and drink were no longer having to be raised and lowered from the second floor, were still transfixed by the bloodthirsty girl librarian from the hills. And when Fred had driven over to see Sven on Friday afternoon, after the court had gone into recess for the weekend, to give him a report from inside the court, Sven had put his head in his hands and not spoken for a full 5 minutes. That day, the women walked down to the library and sat in silence, not having anything to say, but none of them wanting to leave for home either. Finally, Alice, who had begun to find the silence oppressive, announced that she was going to head to the store to get some drinks.
I reckon we've earned them.
You don't mind being seen by an alcohol? Said Beth. 'Cause I can go get some shine from my daddy's cousin Bert if you'd prefer. I know it's hard for you with—
But Alice was already at the door.
To hell with them. I'll most likely be gone within the week, she said. They can gossip about me all they like by then.
She walked down the dusty street, weaving in and out of the strangers who, having exhausted the day's entertainments at the courthouse, were now zigzagging to the honky-tonks or the Nice and Quick, all of which were struggling to feel too bad for Marjorie O'Hare, given the roaring trade. She walked briskly, her head down and her elbows slightly out, not wanting to exchange small talk or even acknowledge any of those neighbors to whom she and Marjorie had brought books over the past year and who now appeared traitorous enough to be enjoying the week's events. They could go to hell, too. She pushed her way into the store, stopping in her tracks and sighing inwardly as she realized there would be at least 15 people in the queue before her, and glanced behind her, wondering if it was worth heading to one of the bars to see if they would sell her something instead. What kind of a crowd would be in there? She was so full of anger these days that she felt like a tinderbox, as if it would take only one wrong comment from one of these fools for her to— She felt a tap on her shoulder.
Alice?
She turned. And there, by the preserves and canned goods, dressed in his shirt sleeves and his good blue trousers, without a speck of coal dust on him, stood Bennett. He had probably just finished work, but looked, as ever, as fresh as if he'd stepped out of the pages of a Sears catalog. Bennett, she said, blinked and looked away. It wasn't as if she was physically moved by him anymore, she realized, searching for the reason for her sudden discomfort. There was only the vaguest hint of residual affection. What she felt was mostly disbelief that this man, standing here, was someone she had wrapped herself around, skin to skin, kissed and pleaded for physical contact with. This strange, unbalanced intimacy made her feel vaguely ashamed now.
I heard you were leaving town.
She picked up a can of tomatoes, just for something to do with her hands. Yep. Trial looks to end on Tuesday. I'll be headed out on Wednesday. You and your father won't have to worry about me hanging around. Bennett glanced behind him, perhaps conscious that people might be watching, but all the customers were out-of-towners, and nobody saw anything gossip-worthy in a man and a woman exchanging a few words in the corner of the store.
Alice, you don't have to say anything, Bennett. I think we've said enough. My parents have engaged a lawyer, and...
He touched her sleeve.
Pa says nobody managed to speak to his daughters.
She pulled back her hand. I'm sorry, what? Bennett looked behind him, his voice low.
Pa said the sheriff never spoke to McCullough's daughters. They wouldn't open the door. They shouted to his men they had nothing to say on the matter, and they wouldn't be talking to nobody. He says they're both crazy like the rest of the family, says the state's case is strong enough not to need them anyway.
He looked at her intently.
Why are you telling me this?
He chewed at his lip.
I figured it might help you.
She stared at him then, at his handsome, slightly unformed face, and his baby's soft hands, his anxious eyes. And briefly, she felt her own face fall a little.
I'm sorry, he said quietly.
I'm sorry too, Bennett.
He took a step back, ran a hand down his face. They stood for a moment longer, shifting a little on their feet.
Well, he said eventually, if I don't see you before you leave, safe travels.
She nodded. He headed for the door. As he reached it, he turned, his voice lifting a little to be heard.
Oh, thought you'd like to know. I'm fixing to get the slurry dams made up, with proper housing and a cement base, so they can't burst again.
Your father agreed to that?
He will.
The smallest smile, a flash of someone she had once known.
That's good news, Bennett. Really good news.
Yeah. Well, he looked down. It's a start.
With that, her husband tipped his hat, opened the door, and was swallowed by the crowd still milling around outside.
The sheriff didn't speak to his daughters? Why not?
Sophia shook her head.
It doesn't make no sense to me.
Makes perfect sense to me,
said Kathleen from the corner, where she was stitching a broken stirrup leather, grimacing as she forced the huge needle through the leather.
They got all the way up to Arnott's Ridge, to a family they was expecting trouble from. They figured the girls wouldn't know nothing about their daddy's movements, given he was a known drunk who used to disappear for days on end. So they knock a few times, get told to get, then give up and come back down, and it takes them half a day each way to do it.
McCullough was a sundowner, and a mean one at that, said Beth. Might be the sheriff didn't want to push them too hard, in case they told him something he didn't want to hear. They need him to sound like a good man to make Marge seem bad.
But surely our lawyer should have gone asking questions.
Mr. Fancy Pants out of Lexington? You think he's going to ride a mule half a day up to Arnott's Ridge to speak with a bunch of angry hillbillies? I don't see how this is going to help us none, said Beth. If they won't talk to the sheriff's men, they ain't hardly going to talk to us. That may be exactly why they would talk to us, said Kathleen.
Izzy pointed at the wall.
Marjorie put the McCullough house on the list of places not to go to. On no account. Look, it says so right here.
Well, maybe she was just doing what everyone's done to her, said Alice. Going on gossip without actually looking at the facts.
Those girls haven't been seen in town for nigh on 10 years, Kathleen murmured. Word is their daddy wouldn't let them leave the house after their mama disappeared. One of those families that just stays in the shadows.
Alice thought of Marjorie's words, words that had rung through her